With me in the studio now is a preacher, a minister who's well loved among the Hope 103.2 audience. He is Simon Manchester. As the head of St. Thomas's Anglican Church at North Sydney, Simon's messages are broadcast across Sydney through this station every Sunday morning, which makes him a big influencer and something of a spiritual leader for many people. But that's only part of Simon's story. One lesser-known chapter of his life is his unlikely relationship with a man who's considered one of Australia's most infamous murderers. That man is Bronson Blessington, who, at the age of 14, joined with a group of other teenagers in brutally raping and murdering 20-year-old Janine Balding in Minchinbury in Sydney's West. Blessington is behind bars for life, never to be released. But after 26 years, his dream is to have his life sentence reviewed. He says he's a dramatically changed man and he wants to be considered for release. Simon Manchester is one of his biggest supporters. Simon's relationship with Bronson began 11 years ago when a letter arrived in the mail. Simon Manchester, thanks for coming in for this chat.
Pleasure, thank you.
So continue that story for us about how you first heard about Bronson Blessington and that letter in the mail.
Yeah, well, I got this letter out of the blue. And there was a testimony attached, and the letter was basically from him saying that he had been listening to sermons on 103.2, and he basically expressed gratitude and introduced himself, thought I might be interested in his story.
Mm. And you talk about his testimony. So what did that story tell of his experience and his transformation, I believe, inside prison?
Yeah, well, I suppose he would have sent that to me when he was about 30, and it was a very God-honoring testimony. I think that was the thing that struck me. He was really saying, not, you know, woe is me or I have been badly treated, but I am a person who has sinned very greatly. And I'm deeply grateful for the way God has had mercy on me, and I wanted you to know.
Mm. And he shared with you about his conversion to Christian faith. When did that happen?
Well, he went into prison in about late 88 or 89 when he was 14. And at the age of 16, a pastor and a group of young people came to visit in the jail, and they told him the message of Jesus Christ. And he very keenly and obviously believed and was quite quickly changed by that.
You visited him in prison a number of times. When you first met him, how would you describe the man that you got to know?
Well, I must say I went along a little bit suspicious. You know, I didn't really know whether this was a real thing or not. And I found myself alone with him in Parklea Prison, maximum security. And I was immediately struck by the fact that he was very gentle. He was very humble. Mm. He was very broken about what he'd done. You know, there was no blaming or playing games. He was more interested in me than he was in himself. And he was deeply grateful for Jesus Christ.
Mm. And that faith that you talk about in Jesus Christ, I believe he became quite the evangelist in prison.
Yeah. He went into prison without the ability really to read or write. Mm. But his new faith at the age of 16 made him very hungry to know Christ. So he virtually taught himself to read by reading the Bible. And then he became a keen sharer of the gospel. And by the time I got there, there were 75 men in the wing, and he had at least half of them in a kind of discipleship system that he was running.
Mm. And you have regular contact with him now?
Yeah, sadly, I've only seen him a few times in the different prisons where they've moved him around. He has written to me a number of times, and I write to him occasionally. I suppose he might write to me every couple of months, and I might write to him every month. But he rings me every week, almost without fail, sometimes twice a week. And we get to talk for 6 minutes and then the phone just runs out at that point.
What's the nature of those phone calls? What does he chat about?
They're an absolute breath of fresh air, in my opinion. You know, he never rings to complain. He basically rings to encourage me to keep going in my ministry. He doesn't hear me anymore, of course. He's now up in Kempsey. but he will just tell me Bible verses, tell me promises to look up, and he might tell me opportunities he's had. Sometimes he'll ask for prayer, but he generally doesn't ask for anything at all.
So you'd call him a friend?
Yeah, we've become good friends. Mm. Yeah, I appreciate him very much. And in some ways, he's an unusual gift to me because he is in a tough place, calling me from a much worse situation than I'm in, telling me to be courageous, stop being a wuss and keep on with ministry.
That's very interesting. Now, three times since 1997, the state government has changed the laws so that Bronson Blessington and a number of other notorious offenders will never be able to appeal their life sentences. Those laws were challenged a few years ago and that challenge failed. And in fact, just this morning, only a few hours ago, the New South Wales Court of Criminal Appeal has rejected a life sentence appeal by Kevin Crump, a criminal who was involved in the murder of Virginia Morse. So it seems unlikely that Bronson's sentence will ever be reviewed. Why do you advocate for a man who the state wants to keep behind bars?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing I would say, Claire, is that there's no doubt that he should have gone to jail. There's no doubt biblically he should be there. And I think every fibre of justice says he should be there. And it is true that in some ways he is there at the decision or the force of politicians because the crime was so terrible. Mm. And they reacted understandably and strongly and said these guys should never be released. But I'm interested in asking the question as to whether, if God intervenes in somebody's life and changes them, and that change is real and long-lasting and profound, so that he is a dramatically different person, is there a case for reassessing that person?
Mm. Supporters of Blessington's case argue that he was only a child because he was 14, and by law, anyone under 18 is not yet an adult at that age. And yet, the ringleader of the Anita Cobby murder that happened 2 years before that, the ringleader of that crime was only 18 himself. And so he was only just beyond the so-called child age. Mm. And yet nobody wants to see him released. How is Bronson Blessington's story any different to his?
Yeah, well, it's a very good question. And I want to say that people who commit murder should go to jail and probably for life. The question is, if that person in jail is remorseful, transformed, is there a case for saying this person has lived a certain amount of time in such a model way, having good influence behind bars, that they could be useful outside?
Mm.
So that's really my question. I don't know where the Cobby killers are up to. I don't know the other Janine Balding killers. But I'm really just relating by experience to one guy whose Christian life is obviously real, not fake.
Mm. In a story in the Daily Advertiser that I read, the member for Wagga Wagga, which is the place where Janine Balding was from, Daryl Maguire, he said the community believes the sentences are appropriate and that is where it ends. So in his view, the law should support the community's view. And there's been a lot of talk in these murder cases about what the public wants and what the victims' families want. Where is the balance, do you think, between the community's cry versus really looking at that individual and the mercy that might be applied to them?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one factor is that the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights says that a person shouldn't get a life sentence under 16, and he obviously received one under 14. That sentence hasn't taken place since the 1840s in Australia.
Wow.
So he is an exceptional, unusual person. And within New South Wales, I think the only person who's serving a life sentence who went in under 16. So that's one issue.
Mm.
From a legal point of view, he is getting really what he deserves, a life for a life. But the community reaction has got to weigh up not just is justice being done, but is there a place for mercy? And if a person is in prison and they're not remorseful and they're dangerous and they're careless, I would think there is no place for releasing such a person. But what do we do when somebody has been dramatically changed? That's the question. And really, from a Christian point of view, I think we've got to ask, you know, is our world ever going to take conversion seriously?
Mm.
And I'm not talking about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps or just getting an education. I'm talking about where God intervenes and changes you, like he changed the Apostle Paul.
How can that be tested?
Well, I think if a person is faking with their conversion, they will tend to either be using you because they want to get something out of you, or it will be quite short term because it'll just come for the term of the deed that they can win. And also I've noticed as a pastor that people who are faking their religion are not really interested in Jesus Christ or the scriptures.
Mm.
Now, Bronson never asks me for anything. He wouldn't want me to be doing this interview.
Mm.
He is virtually entirely interested in my welfare, not his own. His Christian faith has been going 25 years through thick and thin, and it's been no advantage to him to be a Christian behind bars. He's suffered a lot for that.
Mm.
And he has a profound gratitude for Jesus and a great devotion to Jesus. And when I visited him on one occasion, his New Testament was worn back to the print. So, you know, there were virtually no edges on his New Testament. Now, you don't see that in a faker.
Mm. A question about the family of Janine Balding and the families of murder victims. There's a common theme of a deep pain that never, ever leaves, and they suffer all over again whenever they are dragged through the memories, the sentence appeals, and the anniversary news stories. In fact, I read today that in 1997, the mother of Jodie Larcombe took her own life after she heard that the man who had murdered her daughter had lodged an appeal against his conviction. So do you think there's a place for the justice system to actually support the wishes of the victims' families to keep a person behind bars out of mercy for the family?
Mm. I'm distressed to hear about that situation. Mm. That is terrible. And I mean, I have two daughters of my own, and if anything happened to those two girls, I don't know what I would do. And, you know, Janine's dad, Kerry, or her brother, David, her mum, Bev, who's passed away, have been through an unbelievable, horrific time. And I can't presume to have sort of simple answers. The last thing I want is to pretend that what Bronson did was not horrific. It was horrific. But it is a dilemma, isn't it? Because some people are let out after a few years, no remorse. And so people are coming back out of jail, having committed murder. And it seems a very arbitrary situation. And all I can say is that relating to a guy like Bronson for 12 years and realizing the godliness of this man, I'm asking the question, is there a place for reviewing and maybe releasing?
Mm.
Now, if it is God's plan to have Bronson behind bars conducting his ministry for the next 30 or 40 years, I think Bronson would submit to that.
Mm.
But if it is God's plan to have him released in order to be useful on a bigger scale, there's a possibility as well.
Mm. And you talk about that pain that you feel when you think about the family and what they've suffered.
Mm.
And when you watch the interviews, you know, with Janine Balding's brother David, and you can see his tears come out very quickly and that pain that's so close to the surface. And he says things like, my sister didn't get a chance, you know, a second chance, so why should they? So as a pastor, I'm interested, what would you say to the Balding family if you got to meet them? Not necessarily to defend your stance towards Bronson, but as a pastor trying to minister to that family.
Yeah, it's a very profound question. I think I would not be talking to them at all in defense of Bronson. The only thing I would say is that there isn't a day that goes by where Bronson doesn't wish he could undo the past. And so if they think that he is careless, he is exactly the opposite. I don't know how he could express you know, what must go over his mind again and again. Why did I do that? If only we could go backwards. But I think I would long for the Balding family to know the peace of God. I really would long for them to know the peace of God. And so if I was having anything to do with them and they would in any way listen, it would be to help them to know how to have peace with God and the peace of God in their hearts.
Mm. Something the family has also said is that Bronson, in their view, has nothing to offer society, and I know that you would disagree with that. How has Bronson Blessington made a difference, and what does he have to offer society?
Behind bars, you know, from the age of 16, when he began to grow as a Christian and then to point people to Christ, he was able to say to people, you know, I know what sin is like. I'm a sinner, and I know what Jesus is like. He's a great saviour. And he has had a remarkable influence. I mean, he has pointed probably thousands of people to Christ, and he has helped maybe hundreds to enter into relationship with Christ. So when I was visiting him once, I was leaving the prison and there was an African lady in front of me. And I said to her, you've been visiting your son, have you? And she said, yes. And she said, and you've been visiting Paul. And I said, no, I've been visiting Bronson. And she said, yeah, we call him Paul, because he takes our boys under his arm, you know, like the Apostle Paul, and turns them into Timothys. And she said, you know, my boy's been converted under Bronson's ministry, and he's a brand new person. So the Lord has used him, and Bronson doesn't complain, and he doesn't say to me, get me out of here. And he doesn't say, go into bat for me. He would say to me, get on with your ministry and forget about me. But I wonder whether there is a wider canvas for him to work on if he was to come out.
Another highly publicised case of someone converted to Christian faith behind bars is, of course, the story of Andrew Chan and Mayuran Sukumaran, who was executed in Bali, both of them. And I'm wondering, what is it about punishment, incarceration, that starts some people on a journey to faith?
Yeah. Well, I think their story is very interesting because they were both given a very high profile as their execution approached. And I think there were many people who were clear that Andrew Chan was now a pastor and that Mayuran was now a very sort of creative painter. And so it raised a lot of emotion in the community about whether they should be executed. I don't think it raised big questions about whether they should be released. I think the big question was, should they be executed? That seemed to be brutal. And so when they were executed, there was some kind of outcry. But since their deaths, I don't think there's been, in the wake of that, a lot of people saying these guys should have been released. So I'm saying all that almost as a contradiction to what we're talking about today, but I'm just saying, I think I'm raising another question, which is, we can be aware of good people in prison. Maybe they should be there for life. And we see that some of them are transformed. And I'm raising the extra question, if some people are released with no remorse quite early, should we think about releasing a person with tremendous remorse over a long period of time, after a long period of time?
You're known, Simon, for your strong convictions about the holiness of God and the consequences of our wrong choices. With this case, you're looking at grace and mercy. And some people might see that as out of character from what they're used to hearing from you.
I hope not. I hope they hear lots of grace and mercy from me. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I see Jesus speaks in black and white, you know, broad road, narrow road. But if I do talk about the holiness of God, I hope I talk a lot about the grace of God. I think if you didn't have a high view of the love of Jesus and a deep view and a wide view and a long view, you know, you wouldn't have anything hopeful to say to people. So maybe you were listening to the wrong series.
Maybe I was. It must be encouraging as a minister to know that your Sunday morning sermons have actually reached inside prison walls and touched the life of a convicted killer. Does it make you wonder who else you might be reaching?
Well, last night I was talking to the police commissioner and his wife, and they were thanking me for the ministry. So I think if you get the police commissioner and people in maximum security, there could be a reasonable group within. And so I'm just very thankful for the privilege of preaching on Sundays as I do. I mean, I'm just one of many, many voices at this radio station, but I'm very grateful that the station goes out to so many people.
The Christian faith, it often flies in the face of what makes sense to the world. What kind of kingdom is this kingdom of God that you serve, where the worst of criminals can be considered worthy of another chance?
It's a very counter-cultural kingdom because, you know, we tend to think the good should go to heaven and the bad should go to hell, and that the humble, you know, are downtrodden, and the proud and the confident are going to go high places. But Jesus turns all that upside down. And, you know, you see that in the whole of his life. When he comes into this world, he comes in as a baby in a manger, and the message goes to the shepherds, not to the kings. And then you see Jesus live a very simple life, and then he wins the whole victory by dying on the cross. And it's at the cross that he defeats the powers of evil, defeats death, defeats judgment. You know, everything gets turned really right way up. And that's why Mary's saying, you know, that God will bring down the proud from their thrones and lift up the humble and meek. And again, you see in Jesus' ministry that people who would come to him, like children or tax collectors or prostitutes, would get a big welcome. But Pharisees, religious sort of bigwigs, and proud people would get nowhere with Jesus. So he's putting everything on a good footing so that anybody in the world will not think of him as Santa, for whom I must be good in order to get some reward. That's terrible. They can hear from Jesus that even if you're bad, he is a God who will forgive and restore and make new. That's the good news.
If there's someone in the shoes of Bronson Blessington who considers that they've done really bad things with their life and was listening to this, how would you encourage them that they could have a second chance too?
Well, when I became a Christian, I learned two things. One is I'm a sinner. I was a very sneaky sinner, aged 18, and that Jesus is a very great saviour. And those two wires came together, and I think it probably expressed itself in a simple prayer which said, please have mercy on me, please make me new. And I went home from that particular camp that I'd been on, not realizing that that prayer had been uttered and answered and heard, and that I really was a brand new person. So I would say to anybody who's listening, you must never give up. As the old sign used to say outside the church in Broadway, failure is not final. And that with Jesus Christ, you can always turn. He will welcome you. He says, come to me and I will never turn you away. And you can ask him for mercy and he will freely give it. And you can ask him for a new life and he will freely give it. But you'll be living under his kingship, which is the kingship of love and power.
The Good Weekend article that was published last weekend, it did talk about Bronson's desire to be outside of prison walls, and also how he had formed a relationship with a young woman when he was younger and called that off because his quest, I guess, to become a free man outside of prison walls was looking slimmer and slimmer. If you could look into the future and it was found that he's truly going to be in prison for life and there's no further chance of appeal, how would you encourage him then?
Well, one day when I got home, the phone was ringing and I picked it up and it was Bronson. And he said, how are you? And I said, oh, I'm ashamed to tell you, I've just been to the beach. And he said, don't worry about that. He said, there's going to be a lot of beach in eternity. So there's a part of him which is prepared to endure imprisonment for the whole of his life, knowing that eternity is to come. Mm. And that's what he looks forward to. So I don't have to solve his problems. He has peace with God. He's freer in prison than most people outside of prison. And, you know, his eye is fixed on eternity. He's ready for the judgment day. There'll be no condemnation at the judgment day for him because of Jesus, even though humanly he deserves it. That's been taken away by grace. So if I was going to encourage him, I'd say, trust the Lord. He'll look after you one day at a time. If he leaves you in prison, he'll give you new mercies every day. If he wants you out, he'll open the doors, you know. In Acts chapter 12, Peter gets led out of prison. James gets executed. The Lord loves them both.
One last question, Simon. Would you say that Bronson Blessington has changed you? And if so, how?
Well, in terms of every friend has an effect on us, but he has been quite inspirational, really, because of the nature of what he endures. When I went to visit him and went into his cell in Goulburn Maximum Security, it would be the size of a small indoor bathroom, and in that room is a bed, a toilet, a shower, and a bookcase. And when they have lockdown, he stays in there for days and days and days, you know, because all the prisoners. So what he is putting up with, he's in a cell. He was in a cell. I don't know what it's like now, but he was in a cell that was smaller than the cells at the zoo, the cages at the zoo. He was in a very small cage. And he has really taught me, I think, what Paul says in Philippians, which is, I've learned in all things to be content. And he doesn't whinge. He doesn't ask me for anything. He doesn't complain. And in that sense, he is an exceptional friend.
Simon Manchester, thank you very much for sharing your story.
It's a great pleasure to be here. And I hope the next series you hear is me on grace, mercy, the love of God.
I'm sure it will be.